TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand. It's Raised by Wolves.
Yes, and welcome to another edition of Raised by Wolves on this Tuesday, April 23rd. Danny Cunningham and Dane Moore with you today talking NBA playoffs. A lot of interesting stuff as parts of the first round are over, parts of the second round are set. Still some things to clean up in the first round. It hasn't been, I don't think, as competitive in terms of just how the series have looked as a lot of us hoped. But there have been some interesting things, and I think the one that's been most interesting to me is just how, I don't want to say bad, but how strange it's how strange OKC has looked, because they Russell Westbrook's been for the most part terrible. Paul George looks like he can't dribble anymore, and just I think that's probably the most surprising thing to me so far in the playoffs.
Well, I think if you just look at that series, it's kind of like one of those classic examples where if you're not a league pass person, you haven't been really watching a lot of Portland over this year, and you know you remember back to Russell Westbrook being an MVP a couple years ago, and just kind of in your mind you would think Russell Westbrook's a better player than Damian Lillard.
Sure. And even with Portland, even if you are a league pass person, they play a lot of 10:30 Eastern time starts.
True.
So you can very much be a league pass person and also be a person that has to wake up at a normal hour on a weekday.
That's fair. I just think, I mean, all year Damian Lillard's been a lot better than Russell Westbrook. And I don't even mean that in like an effective field goal percentage sort of way. Like, I think Damian Lillard is in a different class of guard this season. That it struck me, you know, as we're kind of doing the whole preview bit of like Thunder Blazers, where, mm-hmm. you know, I think a lot of people are moving towards leaning OKC because you're like, okay, let's do a wash with Westbrook Lillard. And then OKC has Paul George. And,
sure.
And like Paul George greater than CJ McCollum, all that. But
well, I think a lot of people probably expected Paul George to be the best player in the series, and he hasn't been.
So I think that's like the second wrinkle to it. Like the first one is I just think Damian Lillard is the superior player to Russell Westbrook.
And that's accurate. That's a very, very accurate take.
And then if it's Paul George who's healthy and 100%, which that's cloudy, like maybe that kind of evens it out. But what we've then seen is Paul George isn't, whether it's health or something, he's not playing at Paul George levels. And then the whole rest of the Portland team has been awesome.
Yeah.
The surrounding pieces there, I think a product of continuity. You think about, I mean, I thought Al-Farouq Aminu was awesome in that last game.
Yeah, game four, he was terrific. He was, I don't want to say the reason they won that game, because Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum had a big reason as to why they were victorious too, but you can look at him too. And
isn't that like exactly what OKC needed?
Yes.
It's like they needed Al-Farouq Aminu on their team.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Then you'd be like, oh, we're fine. We have a role player. Like,
yeah.
And Jeremy Grant played well, so I shouldn't totally say that, but like that type of guy who just gives you whatever your stars aren't giving you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just been really helpful for them. I'm watching that game, and I know this seems like a little hyperbolic, but I thought about Draymond Green, and I'm like, he's just that extra guy who elevates the level of the stars and does the quote-unquote little things. And, I mean, Portland has exceeded my expectations to some degree, but Damian Lillard, these were my expectations of him, was to be the best player in the series.
I don't. My expectations were Paul George to be the best player in the series, but Dame I thought was number two and by a wide margin, because Russell Westbrook just quite frankly hasn't been that good this year. He's shot the ball terribly. I think he is either one or two of the only people in the NBA in the mid-range game that were less efficient than Andrew Wiggins. So for as frustrating as it is to watch Andrew Wiggins take some of those shots, statistically speaking, Russell Westbrook was worse. And that was and I did pick the Thunder. I thought Paul George was going to be healthy. I thought he was going to look good. And I thought that he was going to be the MVP type of candidate that we saw for a good chunk of this season. And obviously that hasn't been the case. And that's been the difference in the series.
Yeah, it really has. And Russ just also, he still made his impact felt during the regular season when he wasn't making his shots,
mm-hmm.
and there's less of that.
And he is very good at being able to do that, and he hasn't been able to put that kind of imprint on the series, I don't think.
Do you think that's a Terry Stotts or Portland's schematic sort of
thing? I think that the level of play in the playoffs goes up, and I think that Russ, to his credit, mind you, plays at a level like that on not on an every night basis, but 75 out of 82 games, he's like that.
Right.
And when everyone else rises up a little bit in the playoffs, it becomes harder to put an imprint on the game that type of way, and I think that's part of Russ's problem there.
I think you're definitely right, and it's we also have this look backlog of the past few seasons of them getting bounced in the first round. It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, that's pretty good, like, anecdotal evidence of
and
you
I,
don't
I
stick out.
I think part of it is we take for granted just a regular season matchup. We don't, yes, Oklahoma City swept Portland 4-0 this year, but we don't know what type of situations those were under. You don't know how much time and preparation Portland can put in for an OKC game on a Wednesday night.
Wait.
You just genuinely don't know how much those scouting reports, they matter. But when you are facing the same team at least four times in 10 days, and if not seven times in 2 weeks,
right.
so much more goes into it. And I think that's probably part of it too.
Well, I was looking at for the Warriors, not to get ahead of ourselves, but looking at Warriors Rockets. And so I'm going back and looking at the box scores from those four times they mm-hmm. played each other. And in every one of those games, one of Steph, KD, Harden, or CP didn't play.
Yeah.
So it's like,
I think
we don't have an example. Like,
for that series, you have to throw out what happened in the regular season. Just throw that away. And in part because I think Houston's playing better right now than they did almost at any point during the regular season.
I am a believer that, like, the regular season does matter in, like, an aggregated full 82-game standpoint mm-hmm. when you're assessing the playoff matchup.
Yeah.
But a lot less so in the direct head-to-head for the exact reasons that you've said. Like, you need to go parse back through. And it was like, was this a Wednesday night after they were playing Tuesday in Los Angeles? And, mm-hmm. I mean, there's – you got to look who's playing. I mean –
Is it their third game in five nights? I mean, yeah. all of these things that don't happen in the playoffs happen in the regular season consistently. And you also have to account that guys typically take a bit of a step up in the playoffs. And yeah. that doesn't maybe get talked about quite as much.
Does it feel like Portland's going to be able to handle whoever comes out? I'm assuming Portland beats Oklahoma City.
I think that's a safe assumption. I can't imagine this OKC team coming back from down 3-1. I just don't see that in the cards. They can maybe get another game. Like, they can push it to six, but right. I can't see them winning this series.
Yeah. So if we're assuming moving that chess piece forward and then close to 50-50 in Denver-San Antonio, is there mm-hmm. – I think that'll be an interesting series to, like, see how Vegas lines it up as far as who the favorite or underdog is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's Denver, Denver will have home court – over Portland, which is, you know, somewhat meaningful, but I've been a lot more impressed with what I've seen from Portland in the first round than what yeah. I have from Denver. Like,
and against a team I think we all thought Oklahoma City was a better team in a more tough matchup yeah. for the Blazers than the Spurs mm-hmm. were for the Nuggets.
So I guess, but my question just bluntly is, does Portland beat Denver and San Antonio, or just San Antonio, or just Denver?
I think they absolutely can beat either one of them. I would not. If you knocked me out cold and woke me up in 2 weeks and said, hey, the Trailblazers are in the Western Conference Finals, totally believable statement.
Yeah.
I would have no problem believing that. I think that they can beat either Denver or San Antonio. I have no idea who's going to come out.
I would have never believed that 2 weeks prior before the
but after the watching seedings, the four games against OKC, well, it's very believable.
Are stupid in the West this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
It's dumb.
Like, but after watching what they've done yeah. through four games against OKC, it seems
deserving.
Absolutely they yeah. do. I think that they've looked the part of a conference finals team without a question in my mind. I don't know that they'll get past. I'm not quite ready to say that, and especially without knowing who they're going to play because they'll match right. up differently against each team. But I'm confident that they can.
It's almost like that'll be the closest series of the second round ones, whoever Portland plays, but it's also maybe the fourth most interesting.
I think that we probably expected their first round series to be the closest series.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, one game OKC kind of regressed to the mean in terms of just they were so bad from shooting outside. They had a great game in game three and won that one. But other than that, Portland's essentially dominated this series.
Yeah, no, it hasn't been close in my eyes at all. And for that reason, I'd be surprised if we get to six or seven games.
Yeah, I think that this one's going to wrap up. I can't see Portland losing at home. I do have to say my favorite part of that series was after game one. When CJ McCollum was on the podium and Royce Young of ESPN asked him, he goes, hey, do you have any words for Jennifer? because he was doing like an AMA on Twitter last year, and some lady named Jennifer just said, would you just win a playoff game already? Because they've been swept out of the playoffs the past 2 years. And he just responded, I'm trying, Jennifer. And he did. And I thought that was very appropriate. That was the first question. That was one of my favorite things to see.
It was. And it's like, they are. Like, mm-hmm. obviously, everyone's trying, but
yeah.
but Portland's on this other level where they're like realizing the gravity of the moment. They've had a handful of years here where they've been just kind of bumping into a glass ceiling. Like, yeah, you've made the playoffs a bunch, but what have you really done there? Obviously, yeah, a terrible last year, getting swept in the first round. And I know they beat the Clippers that one year when Paul got hurt.
And Blake Griffin was hurt, too.
Yeah.
Both of them. I mean, they beat a shell of who the Clippers were.
Exactly. So that just was, like, Portland was never that impressive to me. But this is the most impressed I've ever been by this team. And it's the most, far and away, the most believable version of a team that could really push themselves against, you know, a good, whether that be Houston or Golden State. I think they're obvious, those teams will take care of them, but it's not like this massive chasm of a gap anymore.
Yeah, and I think you can make the case that their Game 4 win over OKC was the biggest win that that franchise has had since Damian Lillard's buzzer beater against Houston in Game 6 to win that series, and that was in 2014. Like, that was so long ago.
And just to have Lillard have started as poorly as he did, what was like 0-for-10, then he kind of gets rolling a little, like makes two buckets or something at the end of the first half. And then to come out in the third quarter on the road in a game that, you know, is it's the proverbial like stepping on the neck sort of thing. And they did, and they blew it up to like a 15 some point lead in the third quarter.
And that was even in, even at the end of the quarter when it got down to, I think, 9, that was only because Paul George basically hit a miracle corner three near the buzzer. That was an insane shot.
That was extremely difficult.
But even they went on this monstrous run where they could withstand a 9-0 run and still have a comfortable lead.
I think it was Paul George's KT tape. That.
Yes, the KT tape made the ball go through the rim. So it does work. You and I were talking about that before we started recording. I'm not sure that KT tape actually does anything other than, and you brought the point up that it lets people know you're hurt, but I don't know that it helps you be less hurt.
They're the fighting necklaces of 2019.
Fighting necklaces were great, Dane. I mean, you were a no one unless you had a fighting necklace.
I definitely wore one.
So the other two series is in the West, or two of the three. I'm not interested in Golden State Clippers. The Game 2 comeback was nice, but the Warriors are kind of like, let's just
a fun game in a boring series.
Yes, exactly. And I think that you can, I mean, Houston last night missed their last 13 threes and went 0-for-12 from 3 in the fourth quarter against the Jazz, and that's a part of the reason why they lost that game. And I mean, James, they just didn't play well. You're going to have that. Utah was too good of a team to not win one game, but we know who's coming out of both those series, so I don't think too much needs to be said there. The other series in the West between Denver and San Antonio, I think, is very interesting just because of the styles of play. And because San Antonio is doing this in a way that's very not 2019, where they are shooting mid-range jumpers and they're only shooting, like, I think 23s a game or around there. I know it's not an astronomically high number. They shoot them at a great percentage, just a very low rate.
Right.
So that series is very interesting to me, and I really have no idea who I think is going to win two of the next three games between those two teams.
Yeah, as we're recording this on a Tuesday afternoon, it's a few hours before
play
Game 5, which will be very determinant, I think, in where that
most
that
Game
5s
tend to be.
Yeah. I'm still leaning towards Denver there and just kind of relying on talent. I think they have more of that than San Antonio does, but it's a closer series than I anticipated. I think a week ago when we were in here, I was saying that was my favorite Vegas odds series to bet on. It was like Vegas gave Denver a 70% chance of winning, and I thought it was a lot higher than that. And I think I've been somewhat proven wrong in that sort of way, where this is shaping up to be closer to a 50-50 series. What Derek White has been able to provide.
Big Derek White fan, just because of the Division II thing. Yeah. As a former D2 athlete myself, I was thrilled to see him have a career game.
That's awesome. And I think, and now this not as sexy of a story, but like LaMarcus Aldridge is still fine at 32. Mm-hmm. Like
it's crazy he's 32.
Yeah.
Right. It's crazy that guy's 32 years old.
They obviously have the pieces and the extra boost of coaching in that series, but it's okay. Here's my question. Like, if you're Denver, how devastating is this to lose this series? The way I framed it, this is getting a little sidetracked, but is it more devastating for Denver to lose in this first round to San Antonio from the franchise standpoint, or from Milwaukee to lose in the second round to Boston?
I think it's more devastating anytime you're a high seed to lose in the first round.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, just last year, and I know it's different, but in the East, we saw the number four seed sweep the number one seed in the second round. Like, I know it's different because LeBron was involved, but it did happen. You see number one seeds lose in the second round, not all the time, but it's not as if it's some unheard of thing.
Right.
Number two seeds, I think, have lost, I want to say, six series ever in the first round. Somewhere, it's a single-digit number. Yeah. You don't want to be one of those teams. There are multiple number one seeds that have gone down in the second round, but you don't want to be the number two seed that loses to a seven seed.
Right.
And even with that being said, it does feel as if, I don't want to say this is house money for Denver, because it's not, but Denver essentially skipped a step. They went from being a team that was outside the playoffs last year, because normally when you see a team make that next step, it's okay. You're competitive in the regular season and you miss the playoffs, and maybe not by as close of a margin as the Nuggets did, but you miss the playoffs and then you're like a six seed, and then you take another step and you're a three or a two, and you kind of keep going. Denver went from missing the playoffs, albeit by a game, to the two seed in competition with the Warriors for the one seed. Not that it was, I mean, it was a competition, but the Warriors, whenever they wanted to, could have just stepped on the gas. And I think them skipping a step kind of complicates things for this.
So, one of the narratives of kind of the second round is with Milwaukee or Philadelphia, those teams, it'll be kind of like a referendum of like, or Boston, like, do we have to kind of go in a different direction, or will we be forced to go in a different direction if we lose early?
Teams at a crossroads.
Yeah, teams like at a crossroads there. And I know, like, I'm with you that Denver skipped this step.
I think you might as well mention Toronto, too.
Toronto, too.
Because Toronto's got the biggest one.
But Denver isn't ever really mentioned in that. And it's, they are at a place, too. And those teams are at a crossroads because they have, I mean, on a really simple level, a lot of their resources already invested salary-wise in certain players. And Denver kind of seems to get a pass as that, because they're like, oh, this like young team, like our best player is 23 or whatever, and Jamal Murray, and Jamal Murray's still on a rookie deal, but you do have Gary Harris, so you're paying a lot of money. You're paying Mason Plumlee a lot of money, and they're continually under contract. And then Paul Millsap, who I think has been their second best player in this series, has his $30 million team option, which they're obviously going to turn down. But even if they
a lot of money for Paul Millsap,
but even if they do, it's like, okay, now what? They don't have a lot of room to get much better than they are. Denver
does. Other than just by internal development. I mean, they're, at the end of the day in the NBA, a lot of times you're going to go as far as your best player can take you.
Yes.
So a lot of their level for, or room for improvement is how much better can Nikola Jokic become.
Well, and I would even say, who's going to be your second guy there?
Sure.
And I don't even think this is like a rip on Jamal Murray to say that he's not that, but he's not that. Like, right now, and maybe he could develop more and become like a CJ McCollum. But
some guys at his spot, it takes a couple more years than if you're playing wing or if you're big to develop, just because
that's a good point.
At times, it's a tougher spot to get down. But that being said, I don't necessarily think you're all that wrong. Like, we don't know that he can turn into a CJ McCollum or guy like that.
And I just feel like they need at least that next to Jokic. And so if you get bounced here in the first round to San Antonio, you're like, okay, we're a decent Western Conference team. We weren't as good as everything suggested. And how do we get a lot better? I don't know.
They probably played a little over their heads most of the season, too.
Sure.
Like they probably should not have been quite as good as they were. I think they had some good luck on their side, and they played well, and they get credit for that, but I don't think that they are a typical number two Western Conference team, if that makes sense.
And who knows? Maybe they roll through San Antonio, win these next two games, and then they go and beat Portland in the second round, and I change my opinion. So I mean, they're in the Western Conference. Like, how can I really rip on that?
Yeah.
But for so many of these teams, if we're talking about your goal is a championship, there are financial restrictions that put a glass ceiling on your team. And I think just in the way that it is with Philadelphia, and it is with Boston, and it is with Toronto, and it like all these non-Warriors teams, you're like, I don't really know how they necessarily elevate to a level where they can be the best team in the NBA.
I also am curious what I think it has to be brought up, at least, what's the landscape of the NBA going to look like if the Warriors are different next year?
Yeah.
Because you brought up non-Warriors teams, and next year everyone could be a non-Warriors team.
That's true.
Even the Warriors could be a non-Warriors team if Kevin Durant's playing for the Knicks or the Nets, or if just they look different, everyone's a non-Warriors
team. Like, maybe we've just accelerated the expectation of what an NBA champion or even conference champion is so much because...
Well, because on one side, it's been LeBron for the last 8 years, and on the other side, it's been this juggernaut of Golden State since 2015.
But, like... That's also a lot of history to show that we've had 15 years of, like, super elite teams being the ones coming out of the conference, and I don't know exactly what that looks like. Does Giannis become the LeBron over there and kind of start... I mean, I don't think... Yes, the Warriors are a ridiculous level of champion, and that's going to come down at some point.
And I don't think we'll see that replicated anytime
soon. I don't think we'll see that replicated, but I don't think it's going to be this massive fall-off. That I think that's kind of a narrative that's starting to spin. Like, things happen, and everyone is doing, obviously, as much as they can to become as good as they can, as competitive as they can. And I think one way or the other, things are going to continue to come together, whether that's Anthony Davis and LeBron or Anthony Davis in Boston. Like, champions are still going to be really, really good. And a close approximation to the Warriors, I think. And then when you're kind of one of these teams that's middling or hasn't super elevated yourself, it's kind of daunting in my eyes. And I think I would put Denver in that group as well.
And I don't think that's an unfair way to talk about them. I really don't, because you don't know that Jokic is going to turn into that bona fide superstar, because he's a very, very good player, but he's not the guy that can go get you a bucket whenever you need it. And that's a problem. At the end of the day, when you need 2 points in the half court, I'm not sure that Jokic is the guy that can just go get it when you need it. And that's an issue, because if you look at the Warriors, and yes, the Warriors are different. They've got Kevin Durant. They've got Steph. They've got Klay.
A lot of guys who can do that.
They've got a lot of guys that you can throw it to. Portland, they've got Damian Lillard. I know OKC hasn't been what we thought they could be, but they've got Paul George. So you can name all these guys. If you need a bucket, you can count on them to go get that. And I'm not sure that Denver has someone like that. And that's a problem, I think, with why they're in the tier that you're putting them in.
We're just in this place in the NBA where, and part of this is our elevated attention to statistics and all that, where we're like, Denver's a really good offense. And Denver is a really good offense. But we can overvalue that in the sense that they were awesome for 82 games at offense in the regular season. But when it comes down to it in the playoffs, you can't just like plug and play your like 1.14 points per possession that you scored in the playoffs.
Like
and that's... That's a thing that I guess I just kind of like wrestle with when I'm trying to assess all these teams and go, well, should we just be building a team that has a really good aggregated offense? Or is it okay to do something like OKC, where you're like, well, we've had our trials and tribulations during the season. We've made some sacrifices to not have shooters and all that, but we know we got bucket getters.
Yeah.
Like it's a weird balance there.
You have to have your guy that can get you a bucket, but you also need shooters, and that's where OKC's failed.
Yeah, it's really hard to be good in the NBA these days. Like, it's really hard to be really good.
It's very hard, very, very hard.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
All right, let's flip over to the Eastern Conference, where all 4 series are essentially over. The Bucks knocked off the Pistons in a sweep. The Celtics swept the Pacers. Raptors are up 3-1. The Sixers are up 3-1. I'm not confident. I am giving those series to Toronto and Philadelphia, and I don't think that there will be any qualms from anybody about me doing that. Actually, both those could be over tonight.
Yeah.
So, but if you're listening to this tomorrow, they could be over, and you're welcome for forecasting the future for you. So the second round there is, thankfully, everything that I hoped it would be. I wanted these 4 teams to be in the second round. I wanted just this awesome Eastern Conference semifinal round. Which of those two series are you most excited for?
I'm really into this Bucks-Celtics series.
Me too.
Just like on a personal sort of level. Like I love series where it's really easy to tell when the coaching adjustments are happening. Mm-hmm. Like you don't necessarily need to have a basketball PhD to be like, oh, I can see how the chess pieces are moving here.
Sure.
And I think that's just fun for it's fun for a casual / serious type of NBA fan. And I think that's what's so cool about the playoffs. And the Bucks Celtics will totally have that.
Mm-hmm.
There's just these like clear pivot points of like, what do you do with Giannis step one? You make your decisions of how to defend that. And then the externality of, okay, off of that, how are we defending the shooters from there? That's pretty simple to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And those series are really interesting to me. And I think you kind of have an inverted example of that in Kyrie on the other side of the ball, and how much Milwaukee is going to be able to slow down that key point and then into their option B in their shooters and players around them. So that game, that series, if you're into the chess match of coaching, is probably going to be the best series. It's not going to have like the star power.
I think it does.
Yeah, maybe.
I
was going to say of Golden State and Houston.
Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to compare it to Toronto and Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And even though Philadelphia's starting five is loaded with star power, I think that this series with Giannis and Kyrie and Gordon Hayward and Jason Tatum and Chris Middleton and Eric Bledsoe. And
yeah, it was good.
Brad Stevens.
I thought you weren't going to go down that far down the list, and I was like,
no, but there
yeah,
are
like
a lot
Bledsoe's
of,
playing like a star. Like yeah, the guys
until,
around. The,
I mean, we'll see what happens when Terry Rozier walks through that door because there are no guarantees.
If he's in, well, there's no guarantees that Terry Rozier is going to be in that rotation.
But just, I think his presence.
Yeah.
I saw the effect he had on him last year.
Yeah.
I think his presence could be something. The one thing that I think I'm most interested in seeing in that series is what Gordon Hayward looks like, because Hayward looked like not the max level player that he is getting paid to be, but he looked better in the playoff series against Indiana than he has all season long. And that's a really interesting thing to me, because that's something that could really swing this series.
I'm with you. He's gotten a lot better as the season's progressed.
Which I think it was foolish to expect him to be really good right away. That's why a lot of people that predicted the Celtics to win 60-plus games, I thought was kind of silly, because so much of their success was going to be relying on a guy that dislocated his foot and broke his leg 12 months ago.
Right. Duh.
Like, you don't, that is an 18-month recovery time frame at mm-hmm. minimum. You are not going – and Gordon Hayward, they talked about on the broadcast for Game 4, Gordon Hayward still goes to physical therapy every single day for his leg, because it's still not all the way 100%. He's just good enough to go at this point.
So that's why – I guess there's two sides of it. In parts, it's encouraging. Post the All-Star break, his effective field goal percentage went up to 59.3% after 50.5% before.
Mm-hmm.
That was the eighth biggest jump in the NBA.
That's pretty good.
And he's like almost 150% of his free throws. Like he's getting to the line more. He's scoring more efficiently. And yes, that's all great. I still have some trepidations about really being able to rely on him. And also, I go a step further in Jason Tatum in that series. And I think being as high as I am on Milwaukee, you need to have those guys. There just can't be any of the mental lapses. And I think Hayward's mental lapses are somewhat understandable from the injury. And then Tatum's are somewhat understandable too from his youth.
Yeah. I
mean, but if you want to beat Milwaukee when they're the home, they have the home court advantage, they're playing as well as ever. Like, you need those guys to be giving you a lot every single night.
And it's very possible that they can. I'm also curious how Brook Lopez will be used, because I think that Boston can play him off the floor, just because I don't think that Milwaukee's going to want him hanging out around the three-point line guarding Al Horford because Boston can trot out Horford, Kyrie, Hayward, Tatum, and Brown. And
that's,
who does Brook Lopez guard in that five? That's a problem.
It's a super, again, one of those coaching basketball strategy sort of things, and we've seen in the NBA in this a lot more pick and roll heavy league where the centers who drop and pick and roll, mm-hmm. like Brook Lopez or Karl-Anthony Towns in Minnesota, it's easier to get exposed because you have centers who can just pop off of that. And if you've dropped back in the pick and roll, like Al Horford can and will be open to take 12 threes
and
when Brook Lopez is guarding him.
That's part of the reason Bud's Hawks had so many issues in the playoffs,
yep,
because what the Cavs did is they would do that, but instead of Al Horford, they had Channing Frye play center. And
yep,
Channing Frye just bombed away from three.
But there needs to be, it needs to be a special breed of center who has no conscience,
mm-hmm,
like Channing Frye, who will just bomb away. Like, it might require Al Horford to be like, okay, I have to shoot 8 or 9 threes a game.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a departure from what he's traditionally into doing. He's
sure,
he's like a stretchy big, but he stretches to like 18 feet. A lot of, he can shoot threes,
mm-hmm,
but yeah, he was the second best mid-range shooter in the league other than Kevin Durant this year. Like, that's his comfort zone. Can he make his comfort zone threes? That, because if he does, that, you're right, that will play Brook Lopez off the floor.
Yeah.
And that's a huge loss defensively for Milwaukee. It's also a loss of another kind of killer three-point shooter for them,
yeah,
this year. And when you go to Ersan Ilyasova, like, that's a drop.
It also forces them to play Giannis at the five lineups.
Mm-hmm.
And while those lineups are, I think, very good in short stints, I'm not sure how that they can survive over a 7-game series.
Well, and it takes away what Giannis does best defensively, that,
mm-hmm,
free safety,
yeah,
thing. When he isn't one of the guys in the pick and roll, you can have him just floating in there,
yeah,
to jump and read and block shots, contest shots. And I think optimized for Milwaukee is when you can have him jump over to assist and gang defending Kyrie Irving.
Yeah.
That's going to make it really tough for Kyrie. But if, as you're suggesting, they can first get Brook out, play him off the floor, then you play Giannis out of being that free safety guy.
Yeah.
And that's huge. I think that's where it starts for Boston to try and come up with an advantage in the series. I don't know. I don't necessarily believe that they're going to get there. It's going to require some serious shot making from Kyrie.
That's a very, very possible thing.
Very possible.
And I'm picking the Celtics to win this series. I haven't decided how many games, either 6 or 7, but I think Kyrie's going to have a huge series. And I think that this series for Boston is incredibly important.
Right.
Because I think if they don't beat Milwaukee, there is a very low chance Kyrie sticks around.
Yep.
The longer you have an offseason and the longer time between the end of your season and July 1st, the more time he's got to think.
Yeah.
And if your season ends May 10th, that's bad news for the Celtics.
And that's where Bledsoe's huge.
Yeah.
Because he's the first guy at the point of attack on Kyrie. And if he can be that little bowling ball for them that makes it difficult for Kyrie to get his initial space,
mm-hmm,
then you make it a lot easier for Brook to come in to help, for Giannis to come in to help. And that's big. I mean, Kyrie's going to make his shots, but if Bledsoe can make it difficult and Kyrie can't play at this supernova level,
mm-hmm,
then you need all of those other Boston guys, Hayward and Tatum, like we were talking about before, to exceed their expectations. And I think that's just asking a lot.
Sure.
And I'm not saying it's impossible. I think Boston definitely has a chance at winning this series. In my mind, the safer money is on Milwaukee handling it, but they don't have the experience Boston does, and that's always hard for me to measure.
Yeah, and Boston's run to the conference finals last year matters
because
those guys have been on this stage, and this is the first time in Giannis's career he's out of the first round.
Like, yeah,
he's never, I mean, I don't want to say not been eliminated by this date, but he's never made it past the first round of games, and the intensity level does ramp up. Like, mm-hmm, for as much of a jump as there is from the regular season to the first round of the playoffs, there's another jump when you get to the conference semis, and then another jump, and then another jump.
Yeah.
Giannis has never experienced that other jump. He had experienced the first round 3 times, so it's not as if that was new to him. He had been there, done that. He just hadn't been successful. This is all going to be new to him.
Aren't you just going to be shocked, though, if he no-shows?
No-show, yes, but I wouldn't be stunned if he's just, like, not incredibly great. I'd be very surprised. But, like, even last year, he wasn't the best player on the Bucks in the playoffs.
Yeah. In my mind, he's just really on a different level where I would be surprised if we don't see something that's very close to what he's been all year.
How would you defend him if you're Boston? Who do you have on the Celtics? If you're Brad Stevens, Who would you have be the primary defender on him?
So I would do a mixture, but I went back and watched his shots against the Celtics, and it was interesting. In the first two games, they just defended him with one of the wings. Mm-hmm. It was actually like Semi Ojeleye in the first game.
Yeah.
And then
I think they used him a little bit in the first round last year.
Yeah, And so they went with one of the wings on him, and then they had Horford as that as a secondary defender to come in and you know, gang defend. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was more successful. But in the third game, they went just with Horford on him. And they just had Horford, like, build the wall in the middle of the lane, get in his way sort of thing. And they became more concerned with the three-point shooters around him. And I don't know. I would just prioritize defending Giannis over the shooters.
Well, that's what I think you have to do.
And so what I'm saying is if you do that, you do the defending him with multiple guys. So you put Marcus Morris. I don't like Marcus Morris on him, but you put someone like Hayward or one of those wings on him, and you have Horford.
Aaron Baines on him?
Well, that's I kind of make that synonymous with Horford.
Okay.
Like the wall, it's the wall up guy at the nail. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Like, come run at me.
Yeah.
Or you have Marcus Morris trying to get into him. Hayward, whoever, one of the wings there. They'd be switching whoever it is, and then you try and effectively double team him by gang defending, and it's that's what I would go with. I think what's going to happen is they do Horford and just rely on some that he's the smartest,
yeah,
and just trying to defend him,
which I think is a safe bet.
I think that's a safe bet. It's just I don't know. I would do something to make the rest of the Bucks beat me.
Yeah.
And I
agree with you.
Maybe just do both. I don't know.
We're going to see a mixture of looks. I think mm-hmm. it's safe to assume that we're not going to see the same thing from, unless it works. I mean,
that's what they did against Ben Simmons last year, where they just did the run into me thing.
And hope that he does.
Yeah. But that, again, that's what I'm talking about, is these wrinkles. It's like you try that the first two games and it works or doesn't work, and you continue to do it or you don't continue to do it. It's going to be very easy to tell what Boston's strategy is with Giannis, and I think that's really where it starts. You know what? I looked this up. I actually said this on my other podcast, but do you know what Giannis's field goal percentage outside of the restricted area is this season?
Is it 27?
It's 29%. That shocked me. Like, that's so bad.
Yeah.
That's so bad.
Well, like, part of it is, so beyond the arc, mm-hmm. he was miserable like the first 3 months of the season. Like, I want to say he shot 11% from three. Until December.
Yeah.
Like, it was
not what you want.
No, that's really bad.
Yeah.
So that's part of it, is he was and they wanted him to shoot threes because they're like, oh, if Giannis can shoot threes, and like the thought was that he had been working on it. If Giannis can shoot threes, it'll just open up everything, and it absolutely would. But also, he was terrible at it for a while. So that matters.
Like, what's going to be interesting for me is I think it's going to get to a point where they just dare him to shoot.
Yeah.
Shots outside of the restricted area. Like really, like, they have Horford just back there, like, 6 feet in front of the rim, mm-hmm. and they just leave him wide open. And Giannis, at some point, he'll just do his, like, backup and rampage into him and get to the rim, and that'll probably be successful. But I wonder if Giannis just has this confidence where he just believes in himself so much that he starts taking three or four or mm-hmm. five too threes many. In the game, and it's too many, and it's kind of like what we've seen from Embiid.
Yeah.
It's like,
Embiid is incredibly guilty of that.
Just don't do that much.
Yeah.
But it's hard. I think it's like cognitively difficult to be left that wide open when you believe in yourself that you can make them. Mm-hmm. And you probably make them in practice to shoot them. But when it's five shots and you make one of them in the game, you're taking away four times where you could have gotten the rim and shot 65%. Like, it that makes a difference. And I will be watching Giannis's frequency of three-point attempts. And if I'm Bud, I'm telling him, just attack. We'll get you rest. Attack. Don't like, because that's kind of like the lazier option, is to just be like, all right, I'm just going to shoot a three on this time.
So in October, the Bucks played six games. He shot 6.3% from behind the arc. In November, they played 14. He shot 14.3. In December, he shot 22.2. And then he jumped up to 30% in January. February, he was actually really good. In the 9 games he played, he shot 40%. And the same thing in April. In the 3 games, he shot 40%. But
so that might, what does that entice him? Is he like, exactly. Oh, I got it now? Like,
but like in, after the shooting 40% in April, in February, in March, he was back down to 26. So you don't know. If he can't hit that shot, Boston's going to defensively, and if they can continue to coax him into taking that, Boston has to feel good about themselves.
And if you're Milwaukee, I think you just run more to get out of those situations.
You have to try to, yeah.
And they really didn't do that a ton after makes or defensive rebounds, or they would kind of get down and get into their set. But I'm grabbing the ball out of the basket and trying to run. And there's been this whole little like thing with Milwaukee all year where they've had their studs like Middleton and Giannis playing like 30, 31 minutes a night. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we can play them more in the playoffs because it's the playoffs. But I think just burn them. Just have them go, go, go. And they have an awesome bench.
Yeah.
Like keep relying on your bench. And when Giannis and Middleton are out there, run.
I'm curious if and when we see Malcolm Brogdon, what he looks like in this series. Because that's a giant question mark for Milwaukee. I don't think that they can beat the Celtics without getting something from him in the series.
Right. Well, it was funny. I was thinking about that when they were playing Detroit in Game 4. I was like, well, if they lose this game, that delays the second round series.
They're
like,
might not be the worst thing.
Yeah, right. It's like, you're still going to beat the Pistons. Like, but I don't know. And it doesn't seem like we have a lot of clarity as to what that is.
Eric Name of The Athletic said the other day that there's going to be 3 to 5 more days before they kind of get a target date. And I don't know if that sounds ominous or hopeful or what, but we have almost no information. Like the initial target for him was the second round, but we haven't really heard an update of whether or not he's like on target, behind, ahead.
Right.
Like we have no, well, obviously not ahead now, but we have no idea.
And so Sterling Brown's been starting in his place, who seems fine when you watch him play.
It's different.
Well, so during the regular season, the Bledsoe, Brogdon, Middleton, Giannis, Lopez lineup had an offensive rating of 111. Mm-hmm. And then if you sub in Brown for Brogdon, that goes down to 93.6.
That's not good, Dan.
That's not good. It is the third worst among 126 lineups in the NBA who played 100 minutes this season.
And
that's
also,
really bad.
If Brogdon is playing, how healthy is he? Because if Brogdon's not 100%, and it's also coming back from a foot injury is not easy because he's probably out of shape, too. It's not as if he broke his hand and continued to stay in shape the whole time.
That's a good point.
I understand basketball shape's a little different than running every day, but running every day is also much different than not running for 8 weeks.
That's true. I hate that intangible thing, but he just is like, he is the intangible.
Oh,
he is the glue. He just is that. Like, and you see that when you watch Milwaukee play, that Brogdon is thinking about the other four players on his team and who needs what, and is obviously less concerned about himself. Mm-hmm. And for Sterling Brown, I'm not saying he's like a selfish player or something. I just don't think he has the ability to handle his own duties and to be concerned about everyone else on the floor. And that, whether it's this round or in some series, whether that's Philadelphia or Toronto in the next round or Golden State in the championship, like you're going to need all the ammo, and I think Brogdon unleashes a lot of that.
I do too. That's why I'm not confident in his return going well for them, and that's part of the reason why I'm picking Boston.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm underrating that to some degree. I just do have a lot of faith in the other Milwaukee players. Mm-hmm. They've found different lineups that have worked, even though I know I pointed out that Brown lineup hasn't been great. They've got so much more out of their bench this year. Yeah. No, they're not playing Jason Terry. They're not playing Matthew Dellavedova. Like last year, where they played.
Connaughton's been, I don't want to say great for them, but he's given them stuff.
They're not playing guys where they lose a lot off the bench at all. And you did when you played Jason Terry, Deli, and Tony Snell. Like
who's also hurt right now.
Yeah, but they don't need him. Yeah. Like they have 10 guys who seem to be very capable. So part of it, I guess, is that I have faith in a bench that they've really worked on this year and empowered. But then on the other side of that is, remember with Toronto last year, we're like, whoa, Toronto's bench, like this is awesome. And then it wasn't the weapon that you saw it to be. So that's always a weird thing in the playoffs.
Part of that, I think the Cavs did stuff to change that too. Like I think they they changed the rotation to have LeBron go against the Raptors bench in the playoffs last year. And that, I mean, if someone's going to neutralize someone else's bench, it's going to be LeBron.
Right.
So that's part of it too. But you're right. I don't know if we're overvaluing a bench, and we've seen a lot.
George
of
Hill too. We haven't even mentioned
George
him.
George Hill's been terrific for them in the playoffs in their four games. I don't know if we're overvaluing the bench because they got so much burn against a Pistons team that, quite frankly, is just not a playoff team.
Yeah, I think I saw something like Connaughton's leading them in minutes per game
in
the playoffs. Like, we didn't learn anything from the Detroit series, but we learned a lot about them during the regular season.
We learned that the Detroit Pistons are really bad without Blake Griffin.
Yeah.
That's what we learned. All right, I want to spend a couple minutes on the other series in the Eastern Conference semifinals between Toronto and Philadelphia. This, I picked Toronto to win the Eastern Conference in...
You still on that?
In August.
Yes, you did.
And I am still on that. I can't change at this point. Like, they look good. The Game 1 Raptors is the Game 1 Raptors thing. It's always going to be like that. I was surprised the Spurs were able to win Game 1 because they have DeMar DeRozan on their team now. But even overcoming that, after Game 1, they've looked like the team we expected them to be in the first round.
Right. Yeah, it's also Orlando. Like,
yes. It's also Orlando, and I understand all of that.
Yeah, I'm going to learn a lot about Toronto in this series. And for me, I'm on Milwaukee. I think they will be able to handle Toronto if those are the teams that make it to the conference finals. But I'm willing, open to the idea of getting really impressed by what Toronto is able to do, which Philly, who is a very worthy foe in this second round. And we still... Even with a round of playoffs, still don't feel like we have a good idea of what this Philly identity is, because there's still been the chaos of Embiid not being out there and playing with the starters.
How much different of a team they looked like when Joel didn't play. They looked like the team that they looked like a little bit better version of the team that finished the regular season last year without Embiid, where they just ratcheted up the pace and went. Where when they have Embiid on the floor, they don't do that. They looked like a different team without him.
But we know for them to be able to compete to go to the finals, it does need to be an optimization of that five-man group.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, it's just they need all that talent to be able to compete. And Embiid hasn't been himself until he was himself in, like, Game 4, but then Butler got ejected, so he didn't really get to see, like...
He did not deserve to get ejected. Well, neither one of those guys deserved to
agreed.
Get tossed.
Let me ban ejections. But... it's really hard for me, again, with them, to have a strong opinion on who exactly they are, because it's been chaotic for them. Mm-hmm. It just is. And that series, I'll say, feels like the one where we will learn the most about who Toronto is and who Philadelphia is.
Yeah.
Because whoever comes out of that is going to have had to play like the best version of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know that. And you haven't seen that with Philly and with Toronto, too, like during the regular season. Is this...
Well, both Lowry and Kawhi missed so much time during the regular season, which makes the fact that they won 58 games that much more impressive.
Totally.
I think that those two combined to miss, I want to say, close to 40 games. And the funny thing is, neither one of them, like, missed the same game. I don't think the Raptors played a single game without either one of them.
Really? I didn't know.
But they played almost half their games without one of them.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable to think about.
And then you add Gasol into the mix, too, who missed more than half their games because he wasn't on the team. Like,
missed a good chunk of
it. It's going to be like Game 1 will be huge. For all these series, you'll be like, okay, these are what these teams have to present. We've seen them now trying as hard as they can with all their best players against a worthy foe. And... I don't know. It's going to be, it's like, in my mind, I know people are like, oh, I don't necessarily tune in until, like, the finals or, like, the conference finals.
Well, we're going to have news for you this year, guys. LeBron's not here.
Yeah. The second round is going to be legit.
Yeah.
Like, and if a lot of those series go, you know, 6-7 games, it'll be like 20 awesome second round games.
Oh, it'll be terrific. The last question I have for you about that series. I think it's fair to say Kawhi is the best player in the series, and I think it's fair to say Joel Embiid, when healthy, is the second best player in the series. Who's the third best player in that series?
I really think it's Jimmy Butler, which maybe people wouldn't think it would go Simmons? Is maybe Simmons the most common answer there?
Simmons. I mean, it depends how strong you are about Pascal Siakam.
It's
an interesting question.
Well, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about before, like aggregated season numbers, mm-hmm. or like who do you believe to give you something in the moment?
Yeah.
And I believe in Jimmy Butler.
That's fair.
To do that.
If he's not ejected.
If he's not bogus ejected. He can do it on both ends of the floor. They're going to need him to do it on both ends of the floor. He's going to have... What that's been a disappointing thing from the Nets series is their complete inability to like defend straight line drives. Mm-hmm. It's like, why is that so hard? That has to be like some sort
You've
of a coaching
very
thing.
Very capable defenders.
Yeah, right? Like, everyone's like, oh, they have nobody to guard Kyrie or Kyle Lowry. And Jimmy Butler's too tall. I'm like, what do you mean too tall? Like,
Ben Simmons isn't a near all defensive guy.
Like, since when does it really hurt to be tall and long and really fast?
And it's not like Jimmy Butler's too tall. He's what, 6'6"?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. And I mean, Simmons is bigger. It seems like an excuse to me when people are like, well, they don't have a little guy to be able to defend the Kyries and Kyle Lowry. So I'm
what
like,
do you need a little guy for?
I don't know. But you listen, you read, you listen to this stuff. Like I was listening to Simmons and Rasilla the other day, and Simmons was like, Butler's too tall to hang with Kyrie Irving. I'm like,
I don't know if he's quite quick enough, but the height's not an issue.
Then Simmons then. Simmons is quicker than Butler. Simmons is lightning quick.
Yeah.
I don't know. It he's seems like tall, a fundamental.
Simmons is too tall.
I think the issue, the reason that they're getting burnt there is because they don't know how to team defend isolations.
Because they don't have experience together.
Yeah, and I like Brett Brown too, but it's not exactly a complicated motion to defend.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so you gotta straighten that out, and I'm not giving them a pass of we didn't have a guy to be able to handle a quick isolation ball handler. Like, that doesn't line up in my head.
That's not an excuse at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Or so you made the wrong moves then. Mm-hmm. If that's the case.
You should have got Patrick Beverley with Tobias Harris.
Well, I forgot about that, yes.
Which they should have done. I mean, if they had made that as well happen, then I think we're looking at a little bit different
right.
of an animal there.
Yeah. I still think they can do it without him. But
I do too, but I'm picking.
You also have Joel Embiid at the back line. Like,
we don't know what he's health-wise.
Well, if he's not health-wise, like they're not going to win that series. So I'm for them to be able to even compete mm-hmm. for it, Embiid has to be firing on almost all cylinders.
Yeah.
And then I guess you have Gasol who's going to stretch him out a little bit, but there's ways to be able to mm-hmm. defend isolators.
Yeah.
And Kawhi's their main isolator. He's tall. So let's, this series.
He's also long.
Let's put that dumb narrative away. I don't know. That bugged me because I've heard it. It wasn't just Simmons. I've heard it a lot of different places.
Sure.
Like, they have nobody to guard small people. That's stupid.
I think a lot of people can guard small people. But,
yes.
Dane, thanks for doing this week. Really appreciate it. You can find Raised by Wolves anywhere you find podcasts. Remember to like, rate, subscribe, review, do all that stuff on Apple Music, Spotify. Leave us a 5-star rating. We'd really appreciate it. This has been Raised by Wolves on Score North.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.